Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 7th, 2019. This is class 5 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Kulasekhaka Sutta. We begin our class with a discussion of jhana, or jhana meditation, the only method of meditation that the Buddha taught, and it's clear that he taught a concentration practice that supports resolving the issue of wrong views of self within an impermanent environment. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Before we get started, Ram, if you got a moment, does everyone feel that their jhana practice, their meditation practice, is doing what we hope it does to deepen your concentration? Yes, no?
Yes.
Yes.
Nobody know?
I'm stuck.
Yes.
I'm a no at the moment.
I'm stuck.
You don't feel like it's increasing your concentration?
No.
Do you find that you're able to recall even bits and parts of the Eightfold Path when it's appropriate to do so, meaning in your moment by moment life?
Yes.
Yes, no?
Yes.
Yes.
That's deepening concentration. If it wasn't for deepening concentration, that wouldn't occur. And that's really why I brought this up. It may not be the concentration you hope to ultimately develop, but that's why we do that. That's why we use a concentration practice. There's nothing magical or mystical about it. It simply allows us to hold in mind, meaning refine mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And congratulations, you're all doing it. You may want more, and that's fine. I mean, that's a skillful understanding that you're not quite there yet. But the practice is working. Thank you, Rob. You have anything to add to that before you run?
No, it's still the practice itself, the meditation practice itself, has gotten to be less of a struggle. Mm. Now that I've gotten my effort right, as to not trying to not think.
Good point.
You know, which was a long time deal of mine.
I was going to say not to interrupt you. It's not really to not think, it's not to be distracted by your thinking. Yes.
And so it's gotten a lot less frustrating.
Yep.
That's been very helpful. So, you know, what happens in the mind and all that is still fairly much the same, but it's now in a relaxed way.
Yes, and so the recognition of it is what is diminishing the frustration level.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's the important point. To just recognize that your Dhamma practice is doing what it should because you're doing what you should, meaning you're developing the Dhamma the way it's meant to be experienced. There's also an aspect of, and I know you're busy, Ron, if you have to run, go ahead, but there's an aspect of, not an aspect, the Dhamma practice is so brilliantly designed that it allows for, in fact, it's the point of the Dhamma, for fabricated views of self to be an aspect of developing reality, meaning a non-fabricated view of self. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha's meeting us where we are. And when I read some of the modern Buddhist stuff that's put out there, it's all abstract. It's all, this is what we're hoping to do, but there's no instruction about how to get there. In other words, live peacefully and be nice to people or imagine yourself in non-physical, all of that. Nothing taught to actually develop an understanding of self-referential views. That's the whole point of this study. It's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. An aspect of a fabricated view, and we talk about this in relation to the five hindrances, is doubt. And so even within Dhamma practice, even wholehearted Dhamma practice, we may find ourselves judging ourselves in a fabricated way, meaning, and some of you just alluded to it, you're actually developing the Dhamma the way it's intended, but because you may not view yourself as perfect in it, you're judging yourself that you're not quite getting it, that it's not working, or your concentration isn't deepening as it should. It's just a matter of continued right effort, as Ram pointed out. And that's important. So all of that to say, in the context of what we're studying, everything resolves on that point, how we think about ourselves. And in Dhamma practice, what is most significant, the reason why I say always be gentle with yourself, how we feel about ourselves within Dhamma practice. And if we notice that we're judging ourselves harshly within Dhamma practice, what should we do? Jen, put you on a spot.
This is not my, me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
That's it, because it's not. Any time we judge ourselves in that harsh way, it's a fabrication. Because you just said, you just proved it to all of us and to yourselves, you're doing the practice. That's all we can do. And be gentle with ourselves and patient. The Pali word is kshanti. It means patient forbearance. It means we understand where we're going and we give ourselves a break while we're getting there. Sit under a shade tree every now and then. Give yourself a break. Okay, that's enough. Thanks for saying. Please.
You always say that it's not for the sitting on your cushion is not for not having thoughts.
I never say that.
Well, it's for not getting caught up in your thoughts.
Yeah, that's right? Different.
So, but we have thoughts. Therefore, we know that every thought, word, and deed is coming from anatta. So when we're on our cushion and we have thoughts, but we're not getting caught up in them, isn't that keeping like a thread or a link into anatta rather than trying to dismiss anatta?
What a great, great, really, I'm not overblowing it. What a profound question, because you're getting to the heart of the matter. This incredible, simple technique that the Buddha taught, excuse me, and I don't want to get too deep into this and miss today's class. That act of sitting in meditation and doing nothing else but being mindful when I'm caught up in my thinking and as soon as possible coming back to the sensation of breathing, in-breath and out-breath, interrupts that fabricated conditioned thinking that you're describing. And so the fact that we're having thoughts does not mean that it's not working. It simply means that we have a concentration practice to address that. In many of the suttas, and I think you probably heard me say it, but I usually change the word, the Buddha talks about five strings of sensuality, meaning the strings are a connection to our five senses. There's a string of sensuality connected to our eyes, to our ears, to our nose, to our throats, to our tactile sensations, and to our consciousness. We are clinging to our thoughts because we have developed a way that our thoughts now represent us, even if it's fabricated. And this brilliant, simple meditation method that teaches us and conditions us away from clinging to those thoughts. So those thoughts that you're describing, and you described this so beautifully well a couple years ago, that your thoughts are down here and your breath is up here, meaning that you've gained control of your mind by being mindful of your breath. Thoughts are always flowing. They're supposed to flow. That's why I give that instruction. There's nothing wrong with having thoughts. It's when we cling to and are distracted by our thoughts. Our thoughts are much like our heart beating and pumping blood through our body. We don't have to think about that in order for the blood and the heart to do its work, the heart that pushes blood through the body. We don't think about it. Thoughts are much like that. Much of the thoughts that we have are simply a consequence of having a human body with a mind that processes information. But we don't have to be distracted by that information. When things occur, it's kind of like driving down the road. Unless you're like me, you're not thinking about every single thing that's coming along. You're simply driving your car. Most of that is done automatically without putting too much thought. In fact, if you think too much about what you're driving, like you were when your parents are first teaching you to drive, you really can't, can you? Because your thoughts aren't caught up with what you know to be doing. And it's very difficult.
There's too much coming into the senses. Oh.
There's too much that you think you have to decide on in this moment. When we calm our minds down, especially in meditation, we realize we don't have to be attached to those thoughts. And that's really the benefit of a concentration practice. Does that help understand that? And Jen?
So just in your question, Lorna, I heard you have like a judgment of having the thoughts. It's almost like you're saying to yourself, I shouldn't be having the thoughts. I'm sort of hearing that in the question.
I should, when I get caught up in them, that's the problem.
Right.
It's not the thought.
Not to interrupt you, but I will.
Yeah.
What do you do when you get caught up in your thoughts?
I come back to my breath.
That's meditation. And so you're not, there's nothing you're doing wrong.
No, there isn't.
Okay.
But I'm not, I don't feel I'm progressing. I don't feel I'm getting better. I don't feel that.
Isn't that the hindrance of doubt where it's just a misunderstanding of what your role is?
Let me let, I'm sorry, Jen, for interrupting.
No, it's fine. What's the progression?
Well, it would be less frustrating if I could actually stay with my breath, which is what I want to do. Basically, what I want to do is stay with my breath. But
having an idea of what you're supposed to be like is a fabrication.
you can really start twisting yourself up in that idea. The practice itself is a solution. Notice that in that moment, you're in doubt. What do we do with doubt? We know that we have to deepen our understanding, but in meditation, there's one thing that we do. No matter how we feel, no matter how we think, especially about ourselves, we simply come back to the breath. And in doing so, you've said it yourself today and many times, your concentration increases. It's just not where you hope it to be. But that the frustration is coming out of grasping after something that you're simply not there yet.
Yeah.
If you look at that just a little bit deeper, but not too analytical, you're grasping after a fabricated view of who Lorna should be, rather than in this moment, I'm not 100% concentrated.
Mm.
So what? The only judgment about that would have to come from yourself. It certainly doesn't come from the Dhamma or your teacher or your Sangha. It's, I need to be better or more. And that is the underlying self-loathing that gets us all into trouble in the beginning. So, Kevin, again, I don't want to go too deep into this.
Lorna, you've said before, and I've been thinking about this lately, about when we finding that breath, and we were kind of in it for a second there. This was going, John was sort of talking technique for a second, returning to that breath. And you've said this before, and I'll remind you, I don't know what talk it's on, but about the out breath. And what we were just describing is this sensory contact, which is the in. We can't stop that in. Right? I mean, if there's driving the car, it's coming at you. But that out breath, and you have said that finding that out breath and releasing that. I've been finding that in the actual practice when the guy was hammering or whatever, and 10 minutes ago, and I would find that out breath and that simple acknowledgement or getting back to that breathing. Just there released any of the thought,
and
it was, and I didn't even I heard the hammering, but. I didn't hear the hammering because the went back to the breath, and you brought that out before, so maybe I'm just reminding you that that might be what you were, just kind of describing, and that is that gentle passing away, and so that was really helpful what you had said. I don't know when, but maybe that out breath, that really finding your out breath, like you had described. One talk.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. That's so important.
Lorna, I remember Lorna mentioning it. She said that.
No, please don't, Lorna.
No, this was something that always stuck with me, Lorna. So thank you. Was when you're up at your breath, that the thoughts were like a river flowing by, and that's the term you used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, and John also mentioned it, and that's for me very helpful because from what Lorna has said, I feel the same way too because. It's not so much that thought. It seems to be the reoccurring same thought that begins to frustrate.
That's called conditioned thinking.
Exactly. So if I can get that feeling of the river, of the breath, I can have that thought go away.
Yeah. The ultimate clinging and craving is for the way we think, and we cling to those thoughts. So this... Within the context of our study and the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma, understanding that our jhana practice, one of the reasons why we do this, is to resolve these issues within ourselves. It takes a quiet, concentrated mind to see what's occurring within ourselves. It's nothing outside of ourselves. And so the frustration comes from not accepting where we are in this present moment, but that is an aspect of anatta too, isn't it? And the five clinging aggregates that we're going to get to. It's okay. The other aspect of meditation that even those that have, those of us have been meditating for a while, still think, excuse me, there's such a there's such deep misinformation about what meditation is for. And most people assume when they hear the word meditation that it means developing a trance-like state. And that is completely contradictory to everything the Buddha taught. Most meditation techniques are designed to do that. The more popular ones today are the ones that do it most effectively. In other words, put us in a trance very quickly and create a structure to keep us there. A trance is simply another word for a speculated, corrupted way of looking at yourself in relation to the world. It's what it's the underlying theme of the Buddha to recognize when we're doing that, when we're creating speculative, corrupted views, fabricated views of ourselves, and abandon those. That's what a trance is. Creating a repository for a fabricated, ignorant view of a self that we can accept. It's hard to overcome that. That's so subtle. But what we are trying to do, what we will do as Dhamma practitioners, is live life in reality, meaning we understand who we are in relation to the world, not create another fabricated view out of our so-called Dharma practice. So that's it. That's why I asked the question, just to reinforce and understand that you're all developing a Dhamma as it's intended. You're all deepening your concentration, and that's what meditation practice is about. And now you'll see how this relates a little bit more to this study that we're in. This is just part of the introduction. In this Kulasekaka Sutta, the Buddha is confronted by Sakaka, a follower of Nagata Nataputta, the local leader of a Jain sect. And Jain was a competitive religion to the Buddha during the Buddha's lifetime. Many people then and now consider it simply another Buddhist practice. When you understand what the Jains are teaching, it's more in line with the Vedas and the Upanishads, Hindu teachings, and most of it contradicts everything the Buddha taught. But anyway, they're still extant today. There's still Jain sects, and there's probably a couple million practitioners still around today. And Sakaka was accompanied by a group of approximately 500 Lakavis, locals. They were a society ruled by a religious oligarchy. Sakaka was a well-respected Jain teacher, known for his intense philosophical rhetoric and debate to show his superior knowledge. This is something that was common during the Buddha's time, and those of you that may have seen this on, you know, online YouTube videos of certain South Asian Buddhist traditions that are founded in this debate, and you'll see these elaborate debates where these practitioners are jumping around and hooping and clapping their hands and doing all this stuff. Have any of you seen that?
I've seen that.
The type of Buddhism is actually taught that way. That the measure of your understanding is if you can defeat somebody in debate. It has nothing to do with what you're teaching. And can you imagine an awakened human being dancing around and jumping and trying to threaten people into believing that he's true? The reason why they did that is because you gained a lot of wealth and fame if you could prove something in that way. It's still around today. There's still people that follow that type of teaching. Sakaka continues, he says, "There is no contemplative or leader or one who claims to be an arahant, a rightly self-awake one, who would not quiver and break out in sweat when engaged with me in debate." Does anyone notice the eye making in that? So if you hear somebody say that, you might not want to follow them if you're a Dhamma practitioner. The Kulasekaka Sutta, the subtitle of this is A Fearless and Independent Dhamma. And again, it's another one of those teachings, and I know you hear me say this, and some people they hear it so often that they don't want to come back, but it's important. This is another sutta where the Buddha says, this is what I teach and this is what I don't teach. And it's so important to understand this. So, and it relates to, you'll notice that the Buddha's relating this teaching of the impermanence of the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates are simply another word for anatta. It's loosely another word for karma, meaning what's unfolding in this moment is me, it's nothing else. The five clinging aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is what constitutes the suffering of each individual human being. They're simply words that describe what we use to say this is me. And each and every one of these things that we insist describe me are all impermanent. It gets to exactly to the heart of the matter and the heart of our study right now. Does everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
Everything revolves and resolves within the five clinging aggregates. And the reason why is because the five clinging aggregates are impermanent, and yet we believe that they are permanent, including the stress that arises from five clinging aggregates, such as I'm not getting this quick enough or I'm not doing it right. It's all an aspect of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Excuse me.
Or I can't quiet my mind.
Yeah.
Anybody
can quiet their mind for a moment to be mindful of the breath. If the mind pops up again, it just means you need a concentration practice. That's all. But when we judge it, we're in trouble. No, we're not in trouble. We just need to bring it up to at a song and talk about it. One morning, Venerable Asaji, one of the monks of the Buddhist Sangha, was in Visali on his alms round. Sakaka noticed Asaji and recognized him as a follower of Gotama the Contemplative, meaning the Buddha. Master Asaji, how does Gotama the Contemplative generally instruct his disciples? Agavasana is a tribal name. Agavasana, but he's speaking to Sakaka. Agavasana, Gotama, the rightly self-awakened one, instructs his disciples in a general way as follows. And notice how he's now referring to the five clinging aggregates. Form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental fabrications are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. Being impermanent, form is not self. The Buddha says that in so many suttas, including the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Excuse me. Where the Buddha says exactly that. If it's impermanent, if it is impermanent, how could it be a self? How could it? And why would we associate who we are with something that is fleeting, is impermanent? There's no substance to it. The stress that is inherent in believing something like that is the central theme, the central problem. And when we understand it, we cease taking anything personally. Why? Because there's nothing personal. Feelings are not self. Again, I could say basically the same thing. How often do we, in fact, I would say most of us live our lives by identifying the quality of our life by how we feel. And once we establish that my life and my well-being is based on how I feel, not recognizing that feelings are as impermanent as anything else, we're really lost, aren't we? Because the world is designed in such a way, or it unfolds in such a way, that it creates feelings out of impersonal circumstances and other people. And so if we are describing my well-being by how I feel in the present moment, I'm always going to be stressed and distracted. I'm always going to be grasping after something. If it's something that makes me feel good in the moment, I want more of it. And if something seems to be threatening how I feel, I'm going to want to stay away from it. But that's life. We've literally stepped out of our own life with that type of thinking. We're no longer in our mind, in our body, in our life as our life unfolds. Feelings are not self. Perceptions are not self. How I see the world based on my fabricated views. Now my mental fabrications are not self, and consciousness itself is not self. Why? Because the consciousness, the ongoing thinking, is not rooted in reality, it's rooted in a fabricated view. And so it can only create continued views of me that aren't based in reality. All impermanent phenomena is not self. In short, the five clinging aggregates are impermanent, and so not self. Agavasana, this is the general way that Gotama, the rightly self-awakened one, instructs his disciples. So Asaji just gave Sakaka, in essence, a complete Dhamma teaching. Of course, there's other suttas that are supportive that help individuals understand that, but he just hit him between the eyes. This is what the Buddha teaches. What he's saying to Sakaka, to someone who doesn't understand the Dhamma, he's saying, Sakaka, your views are wrong views. They don't accurately describe a self. Sakaka says, "What an awful thing to hear, Master Asaji, that Gautama the Contemplative teaches this sort of thing. Perhaps someday we could meet with Gautama the Contemplative and change his evil view." That thinking that this brilliant, compassionate, awakened human being, because he taught something that was so contrary to everything present in his time and today, must be evil. And that one thought allows you to then discount what he taught and develop something else. Except people don't even realize what they're doing, because there's a reputation of Buddhism as something useful. We'll create something completely different, but it's got a good reputation. We'll call it Buddhism. We'll create a lifetime of chanting that the Buddha never taught. Call that a Buddhism. We'll create a lifetime of environmental engagement. Good thing to do, but it's not Buddhism. But we'll call it Buddhism because it gives us more reference, more credence. And we do that with all kinds of modern Buddhist technologies or techniques as we did back then. And where does all this resolve? Within the self, rooted in ignorance. So we're going to change the contemplative's evil view. A short while later, a group of Lakavis, again about 500 in total, were gathered at a meeting hall. Sakaka addressed the group. "Come with me to debate Gautama the Contemplative. If he takes the same position with me that he does with his followers, I will thrash him about statement by statement. I will amuse myself with Gautama." The Lakavis, knowing both teachers, were mixed as to what to expect. Some thought Sakaka would prevail, and some felt the Buddha would prevail. They followed Sakaka to seek out the Buddha. They found the Buddha in the great forest. After exchanging courteous greetings, Sakaka sat to one side. Some of the Lakavis were respectful to the Buddha, clasping their hands in front of them. Some of them remained silent. Sakaka addressed the Buddha. "I would like to question Master Gautama on a certain point, if you would grant me the favor of an answer." "Ask Agavasana as you see fit. In general, what is your instruction to your disciples?" "I instruct my disciples in this general way. Form is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, mental fabrications are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. As such, form is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental fabrications are not self, and consciousness is not self." In essence, the Buddha is saying all the thoughts that you have about yourself that describe yourself in relation to the world are wrong. They don't constitute a self. That is the teaching on anatta that the Buddha taught. Not that there's no such thing as a self. This idea that it's even harder and harder to describe as I understand the Buddha's Dhamma even more. But that we all live in this realm of nothingness or emptiness, and there's no such thing as a self, and we all live in this grand empty void. That's all part of this non-dual, one-mind cosmic consciousness that is all speculative and trance-like. The Buddha taught just the opposite. He never taught there's no such thing as a self. He simply said that what your views of self are wrong views. They don't constitute a self. They're not a self. That's what anatta, the true meaning of anatta, means. It simply means that we don't understand who we are in relation to the world we're living in. "All impermanent phenomena are not self. This, in general, is how I instruct my disciples. A simile occurs to me, Master Gautama. Any seed that grows and spreads is dependent on the earth. In the same way, any individual with form, in connection with form, taking sustenance in form, produces merit or demerit." Notice where Sakaka's mind immediately went to. Clinging to his view of self. And he's using that wrong view to justify his wrong view. Good to see you, Judy.
Bye.
He's saying that, it's almost like that saying, "I think, therefore I am." Our thinking doesn't make us so, reality makes us so. And if we're not thinking in reality, whatever we come up with, whatever we conjure up, whatever we're entranced by, is rooted in that. It's not rooted in reality. We don't understand. Any individual with feelings taking sustenance from feelings produces merit or demerit. Any individual with perceptions, with mental fabrications, with consciousness taking sustenance from perceptions, from fabrications, from consciousness produces merit or demerit. Another way of saying taking sustenance is taking your cues from, or developing your whole being from that. It's what feeds your thoughts, what feeds your actions, and what feeds our words, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. Agavasana, Buddha says, Agavasana, are you saying form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, fabrications are myself, consciousness is myself? Yes, Master Gotama, I'm saying that. I'm saying that form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, fabrications are myself, and consciousness is myself, as do all those that came with me. Notice this is such a subtle teaching on the importance of wise associations. Sakaka is basically saying to the Buddha and the Buddha Sangha that you should believe me because look at how many people do follow me. How many people lead other people into battle? I'll use Hitler as a good example. Saying, I must be right because look at all the people that follow me. And that's an extreme example. But during the Buddha's time and today, most people claim that whatever they're teaching is useful because of how many people follow them, or how long their lineage is, or how vast their lineage is. And it has nothing to do with what they're actually teaching. And the Buddha's saying just the opposite. Doesn't matter how many people follow you, the whole world is entranced in ignorance. What's important is actually a Dhamma that helps people recognize that. It has nothing to do with numbers. But that's the knee-jerk reaction. And I've even had people, you know, get back at me. I think some of you know that I write some comments like on Tricycle and a few other forums. And a lot of times I'll get the response like, how can you say that the Buddha's teachings are what he taught when everybody else says something else? You gotta read it, you gotta develop it. And those that came with me. Very well, I will cross-question you on your statement, Sakaka. What do you think? Would a noble king wield power in their domain to execute those that deserve execution, or to banish those that deserve banishment, or to tax or fine those that deserve to be taxed or fined? Is such a noble king in control of his domain? Meaning he's doing what, whether it's right or wrong, he's doing what is in his power to do. Yes, Master Gotama, a noble king would be able to control his domain in this manner. Well, he's pointing that just like a king that can control his domain, can we control our own domain? Can we actually control our minds? Well, Agavasana, when you say that form is self, do you have power over that form? Can you have your form be any different than it is? Can we? Do we have any control over my form, over our form? Can we have it not be subject to birth, sickness, aging, and death? Can I have my mind not be disappointed when it doesn't get what I feel I need? It's possible if I don't have those self-referential views, if I understand the true nature of self. Can I have my form any different than I want it to be? Sakaka could not answer and remained silent. Again, the Buddha asked Sakaka the question, well, Agavasana, when you say that form is self, do you have power over that form? Can you have your form be any different than it is? Again, Sakaka could not answer and remained silent. Agavasana, you have engaged me in this debate. It will be to your detriment to not answer. I will ask you one more time. When you say that form is self, do you have power over that form? Can you have your form be any different than it is? No, Master Gotama. Well, listen closely to what I am saying. And then answer only after you have paid attention. That's such an important line because the Buddha is speaking with an understanding of conditioned thinking. He knows that when you're speaking to a person, and you can look at yourselves for this, including when I look at myself, when our minds are conditioned to a certain way, no matter how brilliant somebody might be saying something, and no matter how important it might be, I can't help but start conditioning what they're saying in a way that fits my view rather than what they're actually teaching. And the Buddha understood that. And that he's telling him, listen carefully to what I'm saying. Try to get past your own conditioned thinking based on your Jain teachings and all the other influences in your life. Listen carefully. Pay attention. Your answer is inconsistent with your statements. He's simply pointing out that what he's taking as fact, he can't even back up in one instant in relation to one aspect of what he's saying. Your answer is inconsistent with your statements. You also said that feelings are self, perceptions are self, mental fabrications are self, and consciousness is self. Can your feelings be different than as they occur? Can any of your feelings be different than as they arise?
No.
Can your perceptions, your fabrications, your consciousness be any different than as they occur? Doesn't mean we can't change them in the future. But as our thoughts arise, as our feelings arise, as our perceptions about the world, as our reactions to what's occurring in the world rooted in fabrications, at that point, we can't change them, can we? Because we haven't done the underlying work to understand that I'm still looking in the world from a fabricated point of view. But the Buddha gave us a Dhamma to do just that. No, Master Gautama, listen closely to what I am saying and answer only after you have paid attention. Your answer is inconsistent with your statement. Is form impermanent or constant? Impermanent, Master Gautama. And is that which is impermanent, easeful, or stressful? Stressful, Master Gautama. And change is always stressful to someone who's clinging to a permanent view. Likewise, are feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness impermanent or constant? Impermanent, Master Gautama. He just admitted that the five clinging aggregates, that vehicle that we use to describe our, that vehicle that we use as an ongoing experience of stress and suffering, is impermanent. It's not us. It has no relation to a human being, actually. And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful? Stressful, Master Gautama. And is it fitting to regard what is inconstant, stressful, subject to change as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, Master Gautama. What do you think, Agavasana? When one holds to stress, is attached to stress, and thinks of stress as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am, would he understand stress to be able to be free of stress? There's so much rhetoric in modern Buddhism, but really in the world, in modern pop psychology, that we should embrace our suffering, analyze our suffering, continue to self-reference our suffering. The Buddha talks about that very clearly. He says we join with our suffering. And we create whole identities over our suffering, don't we? Many people carry around their suffering for their entire lives. It's just another form of extreme self-loathing.
It's a form of manipulating your responsibility.
It's a perfect excuse for why you're not having the life that you could have. I'm broken. I'm bad. I'm no good. People that in recovery are very prone to this, especially in the way recovery is modeled in the world today. It's something that's always need to be fixed. People that are compulsive have the same difficulty. But guess what? Minds rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths are compulsive minds. It's the same compulsiveness that any compulsive person has. And the underlying cause of all compulsion is I need more to be happy. I'm inadequate. I'm broken. Whatever the condition might be. It's all rooted in ignorance of self. It's all rooted in that belief of these five clinging aggregates. This is mine, this is myself, this is what I am. Would he understand stress or be able to free himself from stress? No, Master Gautama. Agavasana, don't you hold to stress? Aren't you attached to stress? And don't you think of stress as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? And you could say that Sakaka is answering for all human beings. Yes, Master Gautama. Please tell me how a disciple of Master Gautama develops this instruction to end all doubt, to end all questions, to be fearless and independent, meaning fearless and independent of all the other conditioned beliefs out there. Fearless and independent of others and their teachings. And we continue. Agavasana, when a disciple of mine develops right view through the Eightfold Path, they then see form, past and present, or future, internal or external, common or sublime, near or far, clearly as form has come to be. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Through right view, my disciples know that any feeling, perception, mental fabrication or consciousness, past, present, or future, internal or external, that last reference to external, is a reference to fabricated non-physical realms that we might hope to establish ourselves, even if it is in the next moment or the next lifetime or the next reward from merit. That's all a fabricated and trance-like view of ourselves. Internal or external, common or sublime, near or far, clearly as form has come to be. This is not mine. This is not me. This is not myself. This is not what I am. So when doubt arises, whether it's in meditation or any other aspect of our lives, the skillful thing is to remind yourself, this doubt is not me. This doubt is not mine. This doubt is fabricated and so can't be part of me, even though I'm conditioned to believe it is. Like this whole sutta, most of the suttas, speak to this central theme. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. The Dhamma resolves within ourselves and can never resolve outside of ourselves in any fabricated or speculative abstract way of looking at ourselves, because that's all part of this wrong view of Four Noble Truths, part of ignorance.
John?
Yes, sir.
Is fear another way to look at doubt? Is
yes.
The fear of the, I guess, truth of the aggregates in your role in understanding it, that doubt and fear are keeping you from fully engaging and understanding it. So.
Yeah. It's a perfect internal strategy to continue your own ignorance. And because we give such credence, we let our feelings drive our lives, literally. When doubt arises, rather than recognizing this is a fabrication because of our conditioned thinking, we give it much more power than it has, which is none. And fear and doubt are really two components of the same thing. Sometimes fear increases our doubt, and sometimes doubt increases our fear. But when you look at it in the framework of the Nagara Sutta, that's exactly the feedback loop that the Buddha's talking about. Fear is one aspect of that consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and doubt is that manifestation of wrong views of self coming to fruition in this moment. Is that clear? That might be. It might seem a bit too abstract. In the Buddha's Dhamma, in the Bhava Sutta, I think it is, maybe the Mula Sutta, the Buddha says that where there's desire, where there's desire or craving, another word for desire, where there's desire, there's fear. Whenever we crave for anything, especially and most importantly, for a continued self-referential existence in this world, there has to be doubt and fear. And so what do we do when it arises? Again, this is not me, this is not mine. And when we do that enough times, 5, 10, a million times, and every time we're doing it, we're diminishing our self-identification with the conditioned thinking that itself is rooted in nothing. It's a true teaching on nothingness. Agavasana, this is how my disciples carry my message and my instruction to end all doubt, to end all questions, and to be fearless and independent of others and their teachings. Excuse me. This is another important reference to the uniqueness of what an awakened human being taught. He's simply saying that if you want to develop what I teach, you have to actually develop what I teach. And if you try to incorporate, and he's telling Sakaka this directly, but also remember there's a whole group, 500, in front of the Buddha, who he's reminding them that if you want to actually develop what I teach, you have to actually practice it. You have to be mindful of not including or conflating other conditioned views into this, because you won't get it. That's the ongoing distraction. Master Gotama, how does one complete the path to end all defilements, to lay down the burden and the fetter of becoming, to become an arahant, released through right understanding. So the Buddha now has Sakaka's attention, and because of that association, this is using, let me explain this. Because of the Buddha's Dhamma and the non-confrontational way that it is presented, even in what was hopefully established as a confrontation between Sakaka and the Buddha left that confrontational view behind by simply stating what is. And so now Sakaka, he got through to Sakaka, or Sakaka wouldn't be answering these questions. And because he was able to reach Sakaka's mind, he was also able to reach the minds of all those people that he was now associated with, or at least having that possibility. And you'll see how that comes to fruition. Agavasana, when anyone through right view knows that form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, whether past, present, future, internal or external, common or sublime, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am, through lack of clinging to ignorant views as sustenance, they are released. Through their right effort, they have ended the defilements, laid down the burden and the fetter of becoming further ignorant. They've completed the path and are released through right understanding. Again, there's a complete teaching on how what to practice in the Buddha's Dhamma. And the whole point is to stop taking anything personal. Does everybody see that in here? This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. It's the essence of the Dhamma. The Buddha's teaching us from 2,600 years ago, right here in this moment, the key to his Dhamma, where everything resolves. Nothing is personal. We're going to get even deeper into this in the next 30. How many classes do we have? A lot. In very subtle ways, but there's perhaps nothing more subtle that we're going to study, but more direct than this. Everything resolves, and this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Anytime you feel stress or distress, and I say that two ways, stress could be something that you are incredibly happy about, but it has a lot of grasping and clinging. That's still stress, isn't it? If it's rooted in a fabricated view. It doesn't mean we can't be happy or fulfilled and have meaningful lives. In fact, the Dhamma brings us to that very quickly in each moment. But when our minds are rooted in fabrications, this is mine, this is me, this is what I am. When I'm angry, upset, or fearful, or hungry, or mad at my dog, or my neighbor, or at the president, or at the Democrats, or at black people, or white people, pick one. Pick something that we have been struggling with as human beings forever. It's because I've identified with it. And I have a need in this moment for something or someone or everything to be different than it is, rather than the peace of mind of recognizing the truth that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Including the gentleman making a couple bucks with his tack hammer.
I heard that bird before. He is definitely disagreeing with whatever you were saying.
he's living his own Dharma. I need more worms today. What's he talking about? I need worms. And released through right understanding. Released, they are endowed with unsurpassed right view. See everything clearly. Unsurpassed practice and unsurpassed release. Release, they honor and respect the Tathagata, meaning as their teacher, not as not a god or anything like that. Just as a human teacher, in this manner, the Buddha teaches the Dhamma for awakening to Four Noble Truths. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma to develop restraint. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for developing tranquility. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for ending ignorance. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for total unbinding. Unbinding from what? Unbinding from clinging to fabricated views. Sakaka then said to the Buddha, "It is we, Master Gotama, who were insolent. We who were reckless in what we construed, that Master Gotama could be attacked statement by statement. may Master Gotama, together with a community of monks and nuns, acquiesce to my offer of tomorrow's meal. The Buddha acknowledged Sakaka with his silence. The next day, a lavish meal was prepared by the Lakavis for the Buddha and his Sangha. Sakaka himself served the Buddha, and upon completion of the meal said, Master Gotama, may the merits of the gift, of this gift, be exclusively for the happiness of the donors. Listen to this response, the selflessness in this. Agavasana, what has been given to you without passion, meaning without any of me in it, free of passion, not without aversions, not without delusion, that will be for the donors. Meaning, if you're still stuck in a fabricated view, the view that you're doing something as having merit, just your own action, is a self-referential view. That's for the donors. Whatever has come to me without passion, without aversion, without delusion, free of ignorant views, that will be for you. What's the Buddha teaching there? It can be a little bit confusing. The Buddha sitting there as an awakened human being, in full knowledge and control of what everybody's really looking for. But he's not asking for anything, not even a meal. He's simply teaching the Dhamma. That's his example. The meal is wonderful. And we'll all enjoy it. And we'll enjoy each other's company in this gathering. But this is the Dhamma. That's what he's saying. Always using himself as the example. He never sat himself up in a high chair. That's one of the things that he talked about. Meaning elevating himself above people in any way, even a figurative way. How could he? This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. He's nothing. That would be, I thought that was the end. The Buddha consistently portrayed himself as an awakened human being, but in a way that presented it as completely ordinary, because it is. There's nothing extraordinary about an awakened human being. What's extraordinary is not knowing that you are and insisting that you are. Aren't. Most of my own thoughts. The ultimate goal of the Dhamma is freedom from wrong views of self. That's my talk for today. Thank you. Let's go around the room and see what we think about this. Good morning, Jen.
Morning. Trying to kind of string together in my brain all of the stuff that we've talked about so far in this structured study. And I'm still kind of spending a lot of time thinking about dependent origination and the 12 causative links and how that has evolved. My understanding of it has changed or deepened, and sort of trying to relate it to this teaching. When the Buddha taught about dependent origination, I feel like he had this understanding just of how the human mind worked.
Yep.
And he really was just explaining the mechanics of it in discussing the 12 causative links. This is how your mind operates when it's on autopilot and it's sort of left to itself.
Yeah.
And eventually and very quickly can become, can fill your mental real estate with nonsense or anatta.
Yep.
And the feelings that come up in regard to that, the tension and the tightness and the claustrophobia and the confusion, is all something that we have the ability to recognize through the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
And so we can get into trying to understand all the mechanics of that, or you can just say, okay, well, when I feel frustrated, that is anatta coming up against impermanence. That's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling that tension. And if I feel that tension, then I just say, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
Yeah.
Over and just keep saying it over and over again until it just.
So you restore your mind
away.
To sanity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, this teaching is a more a convincing of understanding that anatta really is not self. It's not, it really is not me, not mine, not myself, because it requires a lot of restraint to, first of all, even recognize that, and then second of all, move your attention away from it.
Okay. In place, that's the essence of refined mindfulness, isn't it? To learn what we should hold in mind in each moment. The reference to dependent origination is profound, and it's really the progression. And we studied dependent origination last week, and it states from ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 causative links, we end up in stress and suffering, in anatta. And this says, this is how we resolve that, by recognizing that the consequence of ignorance is taking things personally. The understanding, the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths is not taking anything personally. And that those simple words, this is not me, again, it's the essence of the Dhamma. It's resolving these issues of wrong views right where they arise. Again, to emphasize a point, I say it often, that the Dhamma can only be practiced in life as life occurs. Meaning we have to have a well-concentrated mind to be present for that. If we're distracted by our conditioned thinking, we're never here. By the Buddha taught a single meditation method, deep in jhana. Thank you. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning. I really don't have much to say, I don't think, but this is one of the sutras. I wish we could do some time traveling back, because I think to watch the drama of this debate.
No, I didn't portray it good.
What?
I didn't portray it.
I mean, you always wonder what, you know, what the Buddha was like, really, and the settings and things like that. But this sutra in particular, I think, you know, it would be nice to travel back in time and actually physically watch it.
Yeah.
It would be very good.
Yeah.
I'd say that the word that drawing sustenance has really stuck with me, that through your five clinging aggregates, that's what you're drawing from your five clinging aggregates to draw sustenance, to sustain who you think you are.
Yeah.
And it's mentioned, that's literally the word that you draw sustenance through phenomena, if you will. And I can see that and understand that very clearly.
Thank you. That's an essential understanding. And it's the essence of clinging. When the Buddha's talking about sustenance, he's referring to clinging to all external phenomena to keep this ignorance going.
Yeah.
And again, so that's why we needed something to interrupt that process. That's the Eightfold Path, beginning with a well-concentrated mind. And so when things like doubt and fear arise, whether it's in meditation or any place else, we understand where it's coming from. It's not coming from the Dhamma. It's coming from a conditioned way of, a lack of understanding of what's actually occurring. It's not you. It's not me. It's not anybody. And when you look at this in a broad way, you mentioned something about the Buddha I want to touch on. After studying, reading, writing, and teaching on the Dhamma, what I found is, and it's just I say it often, is I feel like I really understand the Buddha more than most people I've ever met. And that's, I mean, what an incredibly remarkable man. Even something like this, he's confronted by someone who's out to get him. And you don't hear anything in the sutta about, you know, any awful discourse like we have today, you know, this canceling other people out. That was Sakaka's intention, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. But until he came across this awakened human being with nothing to push against. I mean, that's really it, you know. The Buddha doesn't have a point of view. He rests in reality. When you're not carrying around a view of yourself, nobody can engage you in vicious debate, can they? Because there's nothing to debate. Just understand it. And that's an example of what we do with our, you could see it almost a metaphor, and I thought about, was I going to mention this, and I decided not to because it's a bit abstract, but now I am. When you look at this in a metaphorical standpoint, Sakaka is representative of our own internal struggle and the debate we have within ourselves and how thoughts come up that challenge what I want to believe, meaning develop the Dhamma. And that's kind of what comes up as doubt too. You know, we're arguing within ourselves. But as long as we remain calm and peaceful and focus on the Dhamma, the Buddha's Dhamma will prevail in that situation. Thank you. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Happy birthday too. It is late.
Hey, well, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I
made 40.
Noble silence today. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here.
Pardon me? More chocolate cake.
Yeah. Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Good morning. So two themes came to me during my meditation and during the discussion, and that was quality and control, not used together, but separate. And you were presented in front of you a burger and a steak. Okay. Both have the same nutritional value, both will sustain you, both, you know, will satisfy your hunger. But one is clearly tastes better. One might be a little bland. Which one do you take?
Burger.
Always.
Why? I'm sorry.
No, I mean that, and what I'm trying to say is that I'm not trying to be like tricky or anything, but in my mind is, well, why not, when presented that, take the one with the better quality?
You ask an interesting question, and in any situation in life, how do I say this? If we're observing someone, an awakened human being, and they sit down at a table and they're asked, we have two specials, we have steak and we have hamburger, and they decide to take the hamburger, we might start judging, well, what are they? Are they rejecting cattle? Or I can't even say that. Do they just don't like unground meat? Or go into scenarios about why that was a subjective thing for this awakened human being to be. When the reality would be that as an awakened human being, I'm not craving anything in this moment. I feel like having a hamburger. That's not unawakened.
So would it be a random choice?
It would be a mindful choice, meaning there's nothing, there's not a fabricated view provoking that choice.
Right.
It's simply a choice. So we don't lose the ability to choose. We simply might choose wisely. But there's no tension around that either. In other words, as an unawakened human being, I may decide, personally, I'd rather eat a good hamburger than a good steak. That's just the way I am. And I always, just maybe a way I was conditioned to believe. But in my mind, I might be conditioned to think, well, I'm in this fancy restaurant. I don't want people to see me get a hamburger. I better order a steak. That's an aspect of a conditioned mind, a self-referential mind, meaning I'm seeing myself how I think other people might see me, and so I better look this way. That's all this crazy thinking that we get caught up in when we have a fabricated view. But simply choosing a burger or a steak or, you know, a salad, that's just part of having a human life.
Well, right, and I guess what I was trying to, and that does clarify that a bit, but what I was, I think, when we were talking in our discussion prior to the sutta and during your sutta, we're presented with these decisions not only externally but internally all the time. And, you know, we, life, there's things that we cannot ever control. And there are things that we can control.
What can we control?
We can control our views, our emotions,
yep.
The way we react to something. The full path is full of things that we have the ability to control.
Yes.
Okay. We cannot control whether or not a hurricane's going to hit us. Yep. We cannot control whether or not a thunderstorm is going to plant itself over Frenchtown and knock down trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so to stress about those things will be painful because they're uncontrollable.
Yep.
Okay. But then, there is that thing of control that we have some part of control over. And those are that's what I was alluding to. And those are the things that I think create the most stress, at least for me. Because, for instance, I can't control myself being a genetically elite athlete. I'm given what I'm given. However, if I practice real hard and I eat real well and I do the best I can control to an extent the quality of play.
Well, I got, I mean, okay, lucky, no, I wanted to. but what you're I think you're using in a term of the in the context of the Dhamma,
yeah,
the wrong word. It isn't control, it's contribute. And so if I want to be a faster runner, I can without it being self-referential, I can achieve that by exercise, by running more. But that's not control of the situation. I'm simply contributing to something that I want in my life. The only way to see that and understand that, though, truly, is from an awakened point of view. Because a mind that is conditioned will always see, a mind that is conditioned by grasping will always see grasping, even when there's no grasping involved. It's simply a natural consequence of living in the world. And from a well-concentrated mind, resting in the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, nothing is personal. And so whether that person is going to the restaurant hoping it gets a good burger and they're out of ground meat that day, it has a steak or a salad. There's nothing there to provoke upset.
Right.
So, and you're asking a very important question, and it shows that you're developing an understanding of where we're going. And often that can feel like annihilation. Like, how can I choose between a burger and a steak? Or is it wrong to... None of that has anything to do with the Dhamma. It has to do with self-referential views in the moment. So, and in the moment, do I think it looks better for me to get a steak? Or I should get a steak because it's more... Whatever it might be, whatever the conditioning might be. That's part of a conditioned mind.
But see, okay, right. So, It's not a foregone conclusion that getting a steak is a status symbol.
The point is, I'm not mean to interrupt you, but to get to the point, when you take getting a steak or a hamburger in a personal matter, you're in trouble. And if you don't, you don't.
There you go.
Yeah. It looks the same from the outside.
Kind of.
Well, again, you will have to continue to develop this, and maybe a few times go out and have a steak in personally. Because it is possible.
but maybe that was a bad metaphor.
Well, all metaphors are do not apply
right
to reality. Yes. They're based in a conditioned view. So even then,
right,
we know that we're on the path when life choices come up that in the past confused us or contradicted our own feelings, and we can just make a decision and gracefully continue with our lives. And when a decision is rooted in reality, no matter what the outcome is, peace and calm will prevail.
And I thank you for that. And one last thing about the sutta. So wouldn't it be nice if we could apply that sutta to today's environment and somebody relinquish their ego that easily?
Well, why can't, wait a minute. Tim, you bring up another good point. You're basically, and I know you're joking, but you're basically saying that I can accept this, why doesn't that person accept it? You're lost. I'm not blaming you. When we think that way, there's so many people that say, I can have a calm and peaceful mind, but not until we get a different president. Making the point, I don't want to get into a political thing, but that's placing a condition on your own happiness. Am I basing my calm and peaceful mind on who's in office or who's crazy on the other side? No. I notice it. I see what's going on in the world. It concerns me, especially what's going on with young people. It concerns me, but I accept it because this is what's occurring. I don't lose my mind over any of it. And the difficulty can be when we get focused on just one thing that we want to focus on that we're conditioned to see, we don't see all the things that are going on from the opposition to that thing that we're... And that goes both ways. If I'm... I don't want to get too deep into it. But that's the point. No matter what's occurring, if I think that somebody or something should be different than it is, I've lost my mind. Why? Look at it closely, because it can't be different. That doesn't mean that I might take action in a year from now and exercise my vote, but I'm not going to lose my mind for the next 13 months in waiting for that. I might even actually, and I do, this is what I do. I don't spend a lot of time, but when an issue comes up, I look at both sides, and it's interesting what you find out when you're willing to look at both sides, not just what you think is the right view or the like that phrase now that's out there. When did this come up? When did the idea of that phrase woke come out?
Well, recently.
Is it because
last year?
It's the most unwoke. Most of really.
Yeah.
But it's such a good example of where we're going in our ideology, that just because I think that something is good, it must be good, and if you don't follow me, you're evil. It's just ridiculous. But
so wait.
Uh-oh.
If you are find yourself in a situation where you have to make a decision and you feel confused or tense or feel it pulled in different directions, what do you do?
Yes, but you know, you bring up something else.
This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself.
Yeah. It always is, but you know, as you start to understand this, you realize that most of the things, and maybe all the things that occur in the world, I should say, all the things that occur in the world are completely impersonal. But if I make them so by my own ideology, then I can't disjoin from them, can I? And it's such a pain. I mean, this is the essence of the Dhamma again. Excuse me. It's such a painful, distracting way to live in the world. To think that a narrow view that I have, whether it's rooted in something, I don't even know what the right word is. Whether it's rooted in an ideology that claims to have compassion, it's still an ideology. It still opposes... It inherently has opposition to something else. And so it's rooted in ignorance. There's nothing to be, if you're not taking anything personal, there's nothing to be in opposition. That doesn't mean that personally I might not, I do everything in my power to not contribute to anything in the world that might be stressful. But practically, I still drive a car. Somebody came out yesterday, I just heard on the news, that's running for president and said that we should outlaw meat. I mean, how crazy.
This is my steak and burger.
But the point is, the people will follow that because somebody says it without thinking about how ridiculous. There are entire populations of people on this planet that if you took meat away from them, they'd vanish. Because especially people in northern climates, but also pockets of people that live in jungles. And personally, I want to have that freedom in my own mind to decide if I should eat meat or not, you know. It's just crazy how far we've gotten to the opposite of what the Buddha teaches—to take everything personally. And if it's against what you're taking personally, the other people must be evil. How can we you can't live in the world that way, can you? And why you would want to even take that position on is beyond me. Thank you. Good morning, David.
There's so many good lessons in the Sutta. And one thing I have been trying to observe in them is how the Buddha always practices right speech. Is it truthful? Is it beneficial? And is it right time, right place?
Yeah.
And you ask your question, how do you apply that today? Well, I try to, in my thoughts and words, apply those three or four questions. And the Buddha wasn't confrontational, and if he was, he would have just devolved into nothing. He could have gotten his word out to 500 people or the one person in front of him. So,
yeah.
You know, all these suttas have multiple lessons in them, and some are just the example of the Buddha and how he approached that. He went into that conversation with no passion, with right view and right speech, and just practically just much more effective than if he went in there, you know, doing the debate.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, thank you, David. The one of the reasons why it's so important as a Dhamma teacher and people learning the Dhamma is to actually study what the Buddha taught, because then you get this, then you see the Buddha as a human being and how he lived in the world. And there also were many situations where the Buddha would say in a non-confrontational way, but simply speaking the truth in the right context, he would say things like, you're a foolish man, meaning in relation to the Dhamma. I actually had somebody who stopped coming because they had such aversion to using that straightforward word, foolishness. But it's simply describing a human being in relation to the Dhamma. If you're acting in this way and you expect to develop the Dhamma, you're acting in a foolish way. To simply show very clearly what it is and what it isn't, just like in here. Thank you. Morning, Brett.
Morning. It's good to be here. There's a lot of things that was good to hear. I'm just trying to take it all in. I think just the language and trying to get accustomed to that. But it's good to be here. And you know, thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin. It's interesting. You gave this sutta about 2 years ago in the summer of 38, I think.
Yeah.
And it was a long time ago in my study. And I could barely construe what five clinging aggregates were.
Sure.
And I had to take away what I could take away from the teaching at that time. And I think I took away that the Buddha was a very powerful person and was able to convey and convince someone. And now I can see, you know, through your teaching and as our Dhamma teacher, that it's the teaching that is the power. And that's where it's at. So, and I think it comes across very clearly in the sutta. You know, it comes differently to me, you know, after having studied the language and listened all this time. So it's just a different thing how we draw with it.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say something about what we were talking about before the teaching about thoughts coming up. You know, and there are times when, you know, in the past when I thought, boy, I'm really getting this, I'm so close. And then recently it's like, wow, I'm not getting this. It takes me 30 minutes to have 2 breaths in a row where I can focus. But I just read something, and when I read this, it's a quotation from the Pali Canon, and I hope I can get it right, and I'm not sure the context in which it was given. But it was the words of the Buddha, and he said that, know that in the Tathagata, thoughts will arise and thoughts will pass away.
Yeah.
And know that in the Tathagata, that feelings will arise and feelings will pass away. So you know that even in an enlightened person, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just part of it. And to me, that's very reassuring, and it's telling you everything.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for bringing that up. It points to what it is. The Buddha was a human being. He was an awakened human being. Of course he had thoughts and he had feelings, but he wasn't distracted by them, and he didn't take them personally. He didn't use them to describe himself to himself and the world around him. He was, another way of saying that, he was always mindfully present of life as life occurs, which means that he could learn new things without creating self-identities of them, meaning he might see an animal for the first time, and it's just an animal, rather, kind of a vague reference, rather than deciding it's good or bad or anything else. An interaction with a person is always fresh, no matter what we might have had in the past with someone. This is why I say how important it is to meet people where they are, to be mindfully present with a human being. It's often said that the Buddha had these miraculous powers of clairvoyance and he could read people's minds, because he was so mindfully present that he could spend a minute with someone and know everything about them. I've developed that ability to a certain extent by asking a few questions. I can tell what people know about. That's why I ask newcomers, what do you practice? Just so I know how to teach them. But that's not any great mental power. It simply means that, at least as far as the Dhamma is concerned, I've developed the ability to be mindfully present with someone. That's all it is. But that changes everything. It changed my entire life. There's nothing that's insignificant anymore, and there's nothing that's so significant that it takes my mind away. It just is. The tack hammer is significant because it's what's occurring, but it's not overly significant. I don't need the guy to shut up because I'm talking or because I'm meditating or anything. Just life as life occurs. And there's such a... In relation to what's going on in the world and all the hatred and anger and justified self-righteousness, there's no reason for it. There's no reason for any of it. Because all of that, all the awfulness in life that we hear of, and by the way, we've gotten way far from anybody even talking about all the good things in life, and there's a lot of good things in life. But we've gotten so focused on dukkha that we lost sight of any way of resolving it. We've created a situation where there is only suffering, and it's caused by certain people. It's not caused by having a human life. And so the resolution is this kind of fabricated religious view of this battle of good versus evil. I'm right. Anybody that disagrees with me is wrong. And that's really where we've devolved to that. And that's really unfortunate, because we can't listen to each other anymore, can we? I mean, we don't, we've lost the ability to even have semi-meaningful discourse, because we're no longer present. We're no longer in our bodies. We're stuck in ideologies. But the Dhamma teaches us just the opposite. We can be present with our life as our life unfolds. It takes a little time, Kevin, doesn't it, from when you first started coming to now. You heard something in the sutta that is very useful. But 2 years ago, the seeds were planted for your development today. And I'm saying, it's interesting that you and Brett are sitting next to each other, because Brett needs a little bit more seasoning to understand this sutta in the proper context. But how did you develop this understanding, Kevin? By continued practice, that's all. Yeah. And there's nothing special about that. The Dhamma doesn't require any type of special intelligence or anything. Any human being can do it. Any human being can practice meditation. Any human being can understand this. The problem or the difficulty is that thing called conditioned mind that pops up. But when we recognize that anything like that is not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am, I take another breath, come back to the present moment. Great class. Any other questions or comments? So this is a fifth class. Next week, I think it's Tuesday, we're going to do a new sutta, which is Sariputta's analysis of the Four Noble Truths. It's really a remarkable sutta. The sutta itself is new, nothing new to us, but in the progression, you know, we saw what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination. Now this sutta points directly to these issues are resolved in self. And next week we're going to learn how to do that through Four Noble Truths, how to develop that understanding. that's enough for today. I do try, I know I say this quite a bit, I do try to keep these classes, you know, reasonably, I wouldn't say reasonably short, but reasonably not long, but you got to get through the suttas too, these are important. So we'll finish with metta as we always do. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.